very happy to introduce Father Raymond D'Souza. Father Raymond is a priest of the Archdiocese of Kingston, Ontario. He's the chaplain at Queen's College. He is pastor of Sacred Heart of Mary Parish in Wolfe Island. He writes twice a week column for the National Post, which is Canada's version of the USA Today, more or less. He writes for the National Catholic Register, for the Catholic Register. He's the editor of Convivium magazine. Besides that, he does nothing. But he's an advisor. He has been an advisor to the U.S. Bishops Commission on Religious Freedom, and lots of other hats that he's worn that's led him to go bald. But we are very happy to welcome Father Raymond D'Souza to speak about the Feasts of the Faith, the liturgical calendar as Catholic culture, which is an ongoing series of what he's doing for his students at Queen's College. So welcome, Father Raymond.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you. This is my, I think, third or fourth time coming to the seminar. Roger invited me. So I look forward to it every year, and I hope that I can make a contribution to your enjoyment of it this year. The first time I actually spoke at the seminar was 3 years ago. I had been appointed to the American Bishops Committee, Special Committee for Religious Liberty, in the fall of 2011. So 2012 I spoke about that topic here. My term is over. I finished in 3 years, and I finished in November. But if you recall what I said there, don't expect that you would, but people always used to say about religious liberty questions when I'd go to these meetings, I was the only Canadian on this group, and it's a very depressing committee to be on because it deals all with bad news, difficult situations. And at the breaks, they'd often console themselves being Americans by saying, well, things must be much worse in Canada. Just because they must be, right? And I used to say then that in some ways they were, some ways they weren't, but I said it'll be nothing as what will happen in the United States when the wheel turns. Because although Americans have much to be proud of with their political culture, it is by world standards kind of an extreme political culture. It's a revolutionary culture, civil war culture. You know, they, when things happen, for good or for ill, they go to go further. And I mean, the best example of that is not religious liberty, it's the abortion question, where the American abortion regime switched from one end to the other so quickly. And now, alas, on religious liberty questions, which I'm glad I'm not talking about that today, it's very frightening. It's going to be, and probably for as long as we live in this room, it's going to be just worse and worse and worse. Where the very fact of being religious is now a threat, right? We had, on my own campus, which is not in the United States, in Canada, we book rooms, and one administrator in one building said, we don't want to book a room for you, to our students, because we don't want religious groups, period. Now, I'm a grown-up, I'm not easily intimidated, called, they can't do that, no problem. But, you know, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, that'll be the norm, right? It'll just be the policy. We don't want you here. And this is happening in different parts of the United States. So that's related to what I'm going to talk about, only in the regard of our culture is growing more hostile. You've heard the phrase, the naked public square, but the public square is a naked. Would that she were naked. Would that she were naked. But she's fully armed. Fully armed, battle gear, battle armor, and hostile. So I'm going to talk about Catholic culture with that in the background. So this is not really about preaching, this topic. But it is related to something Roger said last night in the surveys that you were mentioning, that why people leave the faith is because preaching is bad, meaning that they don't have some encounter with God through it. That's usually what they mean by that. It's usually not a rhetorical commentary, I think. It didn't do anything for them. And the second reason Roger mentioned was there's no community, right? And in a certain sense, that's the beauty of the Catholic faith. You could show up anywhere in the world, go to Mass, sit down, attend Mass, leave, and you've received the Lord Jesus. That's not bad. That's actually pretty good. However, no one else might care that you were there, right? So that meaning that there's no encounter with others. Now, the work that I do, I mean, I have a small parish that's dying. It's in the rural part of Canada, and in the rural areas, they're depopulating. People are moving away. The children are moving away, so most of my parishioners are retired. There's not any future there. Even if I were to be a great evangelist of parish revitalization, there's actually, the people are actually dying. So my main work pastorally is on campus, and there are lots of people around, and they're quite vibrant, healthy. So there we can do something. And so what I'm talking about really comes out of my experience on campus, which is not having a group of people who are Catholic and trying to hold on to them because we preach well or we do things in the parish to hold on to them. We don't have anybody there, right? We don't have anybody to hold on to, so we have to go get them. And either they're Catholic, grown up, and they want to practice, so we have to provide an environment for them, or they're not Catholic, but we have to try and think, help them to think about where's God in their life, and they have conversions. That's what we do on campus. So when you're on a secular, sometimes hostile campus, the most important thing a chaplaincy can do is to create a community, an environment in which people, normal students, can live their faith in a normal way. And because that's such a change from the ambient culture, they actually become super Catholics, far more devout than you would be, than you would normally be able to get people in a parish, right? I mean, of our core group, right, the ones who come around a lot, there's probably what, and we have a few hundred for Sunday Mass, then for our faith studies it's less, and there's different circles. But of that core group, which might be 40, 50 students, they almost all go to daily Mass. You know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a parish where you could get that proportion. So when you do create this alternative culture, it seems to be, you know, more intense. I was once giving one of these talks, and somebody said the usual objection that was very au courant, I think maybe about 40 years ago. You know, are you afraid of creating a subculture? Right? What about you creating a subculture, and people aren't pursuing the larger culture, and are you worried about that? And I said, only half playfully, I said, I dream at the end of my life, should I spend another 20 years or 30 years on campus, that when I die, I can have made some progress towards a subculture. That would be my dream. At the moment, my grand aspiration for life is to create a microculture. And at the moment, I think I've got a nanoculture. But you can learn something about a nanoculture from creating a nanoculture that might be useful. I know most of you are parish priests, so obviously things that I say here are they're applicable, I think, but they're drawn from really my campus experience, although some of the things I've tried also in the parish. And the lesson that I am offering is that if you want to create an alternative culture, Catholic culture, one way, I'm not saying it's the only way, it's the way I've done it and the way I think it makes sense to do it, is to use the liturgical calendar as the basis for that. I mean, there's other ways you can do it, obviously. But this is what I'm proposing, is to use the liturgical calendar as Catholic culture, and I think that's obviously related to the liturgy and maybe broadly related to the work of preaching. So there are three parts to this talk. The first part is the loss of Catholic culture, the creation of microcultures. That's going to be very brief because I don't need to persuade you. I mean, we all know that. But I want to give you some examples just to underscore the point. The second part is theological, which is the Sabbath and time as the theological basis for culture. I've been thinking about that more recently and why I think the liturgical calendar, the rhythms of the liturgical year are the way forward for us. There's a theological basis because actually Christian culture is related to time and not to space, which is something I didn't really think about before, but it is, and we'll turn to the maestro of the liturgy, Cardinal Ratzinger Benedict, for guidance on that. And then we'll get to the practical part, for which I have a handout, but I didn't want to give the handout earlier because then you might be distracted. So the first thing is this loss of Catholic culture. We're seeing it, you know, in not only the fact that we see its erosion, but even the very idea of it. I think Roger mentioned something about the San Francisco schools there. You know, even the idea of trying to have one seems to be kind of an aggressive act in the eyes of some. So the situation is bleak. We're not meant to be disciples alone. That's a very important point to underscore. I mean, it's sort of obvious, right? We're not meant to be disciples alone. But sometimes when we're providing pastorally for people, we can think of what would help this person or that person, you know, it'd be one-on-one, which obviously a lot of the pastoral care is one-on-one. But we have to create a culture, because people cannot sustain the faith, they cannot live the faith in large numbers or even in small numbers alone. Some people can. But we need to create cultures, microcultures, where they can do that. I just want to give you some examples. I mean, they're not just three or four, just to show what a Catholic, you know, why culture is important and how far we've lost one. This one I just read last week. This is from the Irish Examiner, and this is a quotation from Adrian Cummins, who's the chief executive of the Restaurant Association of Ireland. And he's upset because Irish law still means you can't serve alcohol on Good Friday. And he says, it's tough for all businesses relying on customers to part with their well-earned cash on a long weekend. They cannot afford to open without serving alcohol, and they definitely cannot afford to close altogether. And it's just part of a larger article about trying to change the law. What's interesting is that there's no indication, this is Ireland, you know, that it's, first of all, it's not a long weekend, right? But there's something about Good Friday that this law reflects, right? And the idea behind it is, if it wasn't for the law, everybody would be out drinking on Good Friday. That's the, you know, the restaurateurs are deprived of business because of the law, right? There's no sense that even if there wasn't a law, people might not go drinking on Good Friday. Let me break. Speaking of drinking, this is a bit mischievous, but we drove by the Ted Kennedy, faux presidential library that they built there, beside the real presidential library for his brother. So you know, when that Senator Kennedy was at the nadir of his long public career, I mean, thanks be to God, he recovered from that. But it was you know, when he was down carousing on Palm Beach, and his nephew William Kennedy Smith was charged with rape. That was in 1991. Now that was on Good Friday, right? So they were down there in Palm Beach, and at the Kennedy mansion there. And what had happened was that Stephen Smith, who's the brother-in-law of Ted Kennedy, had died about 6 months earlier. And this was the first time that the Kennedys, Ted Kennedy's family, and the Smith family were together. He was very close. He was feeling very melancholy, and you know, very emotional after this. So around midnight, he decides to go out to O'Bar down there in Palm Beach with his son Patrick and his nephew William Kennedy, and they go out carousing, and then they bring a couple of women back, and Ted goes to bed, and then there's a rape charge for which William Kennedy Smith was acquitted. What's interesting in that whole thing, first of all, is that no one really commented that the great patriarch of one of the great Catholic families was out drinking at O'Bar in Palm Beach on Good Friday. That's the negative side. I mean, it speaks very ill of the late senator. But the other thing is that if Catholic culture had been more robust in 1991, even if he wasn't personally devout, what would Ted Kennedy have done? He would have felt at least obliged, being the head of a large Catholic family, to go to the Good Friday Passion Service, to go to the Stations of the Cross, which may well have helped him with the melancholy he was feeling over the death of his brother-in-law, which I'm sure was authentic. So there's an example. I mean, it's one thing you can say, here's an example of even a great Catholic patriarch completely devoid of Catholic culture if he's going out carousing on Good Friday. But also, this is the what a loss of the Catholic culture meant. There's something that the Passion would likely have. I mean, he wasn't a man unmoved by, you know, things of God. Would have comforted him. And because that Catholic culture had dissipated by that time, he was deprived of that. I read a couple years ago, in conjunction with the Queen's Diamond Jubilee, which was in 2012, there was one of these many profiles in the Daily Mail, which I think is the largest I think the Daily Mail Online is the largest largest news site in the world, I think. But this really struck me because it was written about... So the Queen goes up to Sandringham, which is one of her residences, for Christmas. She spends Christmas there, and she stays there until February. And her father, George VI, died on February 6th. That's her accession day. And she always remains there in private because she's always observed it, not as the day of her celebration, but the day of mourning for her father. So this is what the Daily Mail writes about this. Bizarrely, says the Daily Mail, the Christmas decorations stay up throughout that time at her insistence. Okay. So this is the contrast between a Christian culture, in this case not necessarily Catholic, and the culture we have. Our Christmas practices are that decorations go up sometime, I don't know. In Canada, usually mid-November. But in the United States, it's much worse. I mean, I think you see Christmas things up maybe early November. So that wouldn't be considered bizarre, to have Christmas decorations up. But the Queen has them from Christmas until February. Now, she's observing the older tradition that Christmas lasted till February 2nd. I don't think it has much to do with the death anniversary of her father, the King. But it's considered bizarre. Now, in this case, it's bizarre in a harmless way. The old woman has some weird customs. But it's a very short step from being considered bizarre to being ridiculed, right? No, the Queen doesn't really care what the Daily Mail says about how she decorates Sandringham. But if you're a student on campus, or you're a young family in a parish, and people think you're bizarre because you keep your Christmas tree up till January 6th, let alone February 2nd, that's an obstacle to the faith. So if you want people to live that, you have to find some way other people can live it. Otherwise, they won't, right? So these are just some basic examples. There's an article in the February 2015 First Things about basically Christian culture in America. And Rod Dreher, if you know, it's pronounced Dreher, he used to be Catholic. He left the Catholic Church over the sex abuse scandals to become Orthodox. And I think he lives in Dallas, but I'm not sure. Do you know where he lives?
Yes.
Dallas. Anyway, this is what he writes. He says, there are no safe places to raise Christian kids in America, other than the countercultural places we make for ourselves together. If we do not form our consciences and consciences of our children to be distinctly Christian and distinctly countercultural, even if that means some degree of intentional separation from the mainstream, we are not going to survive. So I would agree with that. And whether a counterculture is a subculture or a microculture or a nanoculture, that's what Roger is saying is about our situation. I think that's correct. So let's turn then to what should be the basis of this culture, which leads to the practical suggestions. But the premise here is that if we want to create a Catholic culture, it has to be organized around time, the rhythms of the year. Now, we can just sort of establish that premise and go on to talk about practicalities, but it's worth, I think, thinking about why our culture should be oriented around time. It's very hard for us to think outside of a world shaped by Christianity, even though we live in a world that maybe is losing its Christian vitality. Just for example, in the paper I write for the National Post, Easter time and so forth, they did this thing, they invite people to write in, do you believe in God? And they had the whole page of letters yesterday's paper, quite thoughtful responses. Almost all of the objections were some variation on the question of suffering and the suffering of the innocent, which is obviously an ancient objection. But the premise of why that means there can't be God is that God is good and loving. Suffering in the world, wickedness in the world, is completely compatible with a God or gods who are capricious, arbitrary, and cruel, of which the ancient world was full of them. Most of the gods were. If you ever want to be provocative in a multicultural way, go to a sort of very, you've got lots in Boston here, sort of elite universities for intelligent people, and read to them the creation myths of what you'd call Native Americans, or Aztecs, or Mayans. They're horrible, full of all kinds of capriciousness and arbitrariness, and so forth. But that's what I mean. The world is so shaped by Christianity, in our world, that people say, if there's wickedness in the world, that means there can't be a God because God is good. Well, that premise, God is good, is just taken. So we still live in this world that is shaped by Christianity. And so it's hard for us to think of what a culture not organized by the liturgical year, by seasons and sacred things is like. It's what we assume. But it's worth thinking about how that came to be. So I want to talk about that for a little bit. And the basis, or one basis for it, you go back to Genesis for everything, but this is Leviticus 23, I think. 23. The Lord said to Moses, "Say to the people of Israel, the appointed feasts of the Lord, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, my appointed feasts are these. 6 days shall work be done, but on the seventh day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwellings. These are the appointed feasts of the Lord, the holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at the time appointed for them. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, in the evenings, the Lord's Passover, on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread," and so on, goes on. So, right there in the regulation of the life of the chosen people is the appointment of feasts. So there's the Sabbath. The Sabbath, of course, has its origins in Genesis, in the account of Genesis. But that is extended then to the appointment of feasts of holy convocations, and they're given by the Lord. The Lord tells Moses, do this for the people. So that might, you might say that's the roots of the liturgical calendar. Can find them throughout the Pentateuch, but Leviticus 23 is as good a place. So that's the, if you want to say, the biblical basis for a liturgical year. And of course we see in the New Testament that both the Holy Family and the Lord Jesus himself observe the liturgical year. It's quite common. They're going up for the feasts, observing of the feasts. Now, how is this different? Well, this is a commentary on these passages by Abraham Joshua Heschel. Does anybody know this man, Heschel?
Sure.
Very well known. He's an American, died I think in the late 60s, early 70s. I was introduced to him because Father Newhouse, my mentor, when he was a young Lutheran, worked with him on various sort of social action things, Vietnam, anti-Vietnam war things, and so they got to know each other, and he was very distinguished, and he wrote a very interesting book. It's only about a very thin book called The Sabbath. It's certainly worth reading. I've certainly profited from it, The Sabbath. And this is taken from that book. So Rabbi Heschel says, "Holiness in space, in nature, was known in other religions. In fact, it's very common in the ancient world." Right? And you see that actually in the first pilgrimages of Abraham and so forth, that he sets up, you know, he comes to a certain place and he builds an altar there to the Lord. So it's known in other religions in the ancient world. "New in the teaching of Judaism," this is Heschel, "new in the teaching of Judaism was the idea of holiness, was that the idea of holiness was gradually shifted from space to time, from the realm of nature to the realm of history, from things to events. The physical world became divested of any inherent sanctity. There were no naturally sacred plants or animals anymore." Think of, for example, in contrast to Egypt. Or Native Americans, as you'd call them. "There were no naturally sacred plants or animals anymore. To be sacred, a thing had to be consecrated by a conscious act of a man. The quality of holiness is not in the grain of matter. It is a preciousness bestowed upon things by an act of consecration and persisting in relation to God." So even the holy things that we have aren't holy in themselves. They're holy because we have set them aside. There's not a natural holiness in place or matter, according to Heschel. "The emphasis on time is a predominant feature of prophetic thinking. The day of the Lord is more important to the prophets than the house of the Lord. Mankind is split into nations and divided into states." This is Heschel still. "It is a moment in time, the messianic end of days, that will give back to man what a thing in space, the Tower of Babel, had taken away." It's a very interesting point Heschel makes. The aspiration for the unity of mankind was achieved, the aspiration was sought to be achieved through the building of a place, the tower. Because of that, it was lost. the unity of mankind. This is Heschel's argument. And it will be restored to him not by another place, but by a time, the messianic time at the end of days, in which the hope of restoring the unity of all men will be accomplished. So that's Heschel on the sort of Judaic roots. Now we see this, I think we can see this in the scriptures, in the our scriptures, the Gospels, in the contrast between the temple and the synagogue. The temple, of course, is central to Judaism. So you have this shift from sacred places to sacred time, but the temple is still very central in the life of the Jewish people. Jesus, though, while he participates in the temple worship, is a man really of the synagogue. We'll get to develop this a little bit more. Where you see that shift from the house of the Lord to the day of the Lord is in the great prophecy of Isaiah, where he says the Messiah comes to proclaim not a holy place, but the year of the Lord's favor. Jesus then says this is fulfilled where? Not in the temple, but in the synagogue, and in fact, what must be one of the most insignificant synagogues anywhere in Nazareth. If you think of the whole land of Israel, Nazareth was nothing. I'm told, I've been there many times, I'm told that it was a village of a few hundred people. The synagogue may have been no bigger than this room. So for the Lord Jesus to say this is being fulfilled in your hearing in this nothing place, in this nowhere town, means that place can't matter. So, but the time does, because what's there is that Jesus is there. It's his, the time has come. And of course there's other places you could find that, but I think in that contrast between the synagogue and the temple. Now, Cardinal Ratzinger, in this book, but I've profited lately, I've been reading more Benedict and Ratzinger. I preached the seven last words this year on Benedict's writings because of the 10th anniversary of his election. And so I've been reading a lot more than I normally would. And that one volume, the collected works on the liturgy, the volume on the liturgy, is really, it's just remarkable. The first part of it is actually the spirit of the liturgy. The whole book is reprinted there, but then after it's various other things. It's really remarkable. And Ratzinger there says that after the resurrection, Peter and the apostles go up to pray. They go to the temple to pray. But he says they don't really go to the temple to pray. I never knew this. He says they go to the temple to pray at the time appointed for prayers, so they join the other Jews, but they don't go and pray in the heart of the temple. They pray in Solomon's portico. Solomon's portico was open to all. It's a little bit before where the courtyard of the Gentiles would have been. But the point is they don't pray in the place of the sacrifices anymore, which is the holy place, but they play according to the time. And Ratzinger says this is the shift, which Heschel is talking about in relation to the Pentateuch, from the temple, the holy place, to the synagogue. Synagogues are not holy places. They're made holy because of what goes on there. And the same with our churches. You know, the plotted land where we build a church is not holy by itself. It becomes holy when we set aside for the things that we do there, the events that take place there. So we'll leave aside the question of the real presence and so forth, because that's also as a spatial dimension. But so Ratzinger makes a big point in the Acts of the Apostles that they actually pray in the synagogue part of the temple, open to all peoples, and it's distinct from a sacred place. He goes back further and says that the origins of the temple, this is David's desire to build a temple. So David desires to build a temple, and he says, now I'm at peace, my enemies are subdued before me, and here I am living in a great palace, and the ark of the Lord is living in a tent. I must build a temple. So it seems like a very holy aspiration to put the ark, put the presence of the Lord, the Shekinah, in a proper dwelling, to have a holy place. And yet, to the prophet Nathan, David's told not to do that. Now, I had always read that, obviously superficially, but that's the benefit of going back and reading Benedict, is that you cease to be superficial about such things, is that I thought, well, David was not allowed to build it. Why? What do you think?
It's his time
right.
to build it.
What's that?
Godward Building.
Excellent answer. But you've written big books about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So you don't count. Yeah, I'd always thought that it's because of the sin, or because David was a warrior, or something like that. There's too much blood in his hands, and so he was not worthy to build the holiness, the holy place. That's not what Ratzinger says here is going on. He says that the Lord declares, or that Nathan tells David, you will not build a house for the Lord will build a house. And I thought, okay, that just means that, okay, you're not the one to do it. Somebody else will be appointed, Solomon will come, the temple will get built, which is, of course, what happens. Ratzinger, this is a direct quotation from Ratzinger. He said, in these verses, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. A breakthrough and a radical change in the religious history of mankind appear on the scene, whose dimensions would only become clear centuries later. Men do not build a house of God. God builds a house for men. God himself executes God's building. And what the house built by God consists of becomes clear in subsequent verses of Nathan's prophecy. It consists of people. That is, the Lord actually doesn't build the temple. Solomon built the temple with the Lord's favor. What does God actually build for David? He builds him the house of David. The generations of David, of which the Messiah will come. And in fact, both when Jesus says in John's Gospel, when I'm lifted up from the earth, I'll draw all nations to myself, the house of David is becoming open to all peoples. And Ratzinger further says, in a different place, very beautiful, that when the Lord's on the cross, when he prays Psalm 22, the reason he's praying Psalm 22 on the cross is not just because it's the psalm fitting for the occasion in God's providence, that it starts off with this dereliction, desolation, and ends up in a great act of faith in the promise of God. But in verse 27, it actually says that I will gather all nations to myself. It's a fulfillment of the prophecy that the house that the Lord built, is open to all peoples. That can be applied as it is to the temple. My house will be a house for all nations, house of prayer for all nations. And when Jesus cleanses the temple, the apostles say, aha, he's making the house suitable for prayer again for all nations. Ratzinger says, actually, the temple had that role, but more fundamental was God was building a people, not a place. And where the house is open for all nations is on the cross, the Lord spreading his arms as over all creation, and that's why he prays Psalm 22. And the most important part of Psalm 22 is not the my God, why have you forsaken me, but verse 27, which I don't have it written down here, but it's, do you have it there, Roger? Okay, 22, Psalm 22, verse 27. So the house is a house of living stones. And this is where I think we understand why time is so important. Because what you and I can do, what man can do, is to build in the order of space. Right? So at one point, this was all just an empty field, and we built something. Something was built here. So there's this building here, things happen here. We build in the order of space. We extend, we subtract. What's the verse? So 22... verse 27 is I went back one. 27. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of nations will bow down towards him. Okay. So that on the cross, the house of David then becomes a house for all nations. Not the temple, house of David. In the order of space, we can dig up the earth, we can build things, we can destroy things, we can redo them. The order of time, we can't do anything about. Man cannot build, we exist in time, but we cannot extend, right? In vain do the, you know, laborers go early to work and late to rest, you know. One of the things that strikes me in my dual life, I work with young people and they're late teens, early 20s, I work with elderly people, and everybody says how busy they are. Retired people tell me, they're so busy, Father. Students, I'm so busy. I'm not denying what they're saying is true, but I just started responding some years ago. I said, well, we've all got the same amount of time. Driving General Motors, if you're sitting at home watching soap operas, same amount of time. We can't do anything about time. We can in space we can do things, but in time we can't. It's fixed. It's given to us. It's a gift. And in fact, even the most secular of people knows it's a gift. You can't extend it. You can't get it back. You can't. It's there. So time, in a unique way, in a special way, is God's and God's pure gift. Now, before we get on to practical things, let me go back to Ratzinger again. This will appeal to any of the fathers in the room here, but even aside from personal preferences, it actually is very profound. He says, externally, this shift, this is Ratzinger, is most obvious in the change of direction for prayer. No matter where they are, Jews pray facing Jerusalem. This is less true today than I think it used to be, but certainly if you're in a Muslim country. I was in Sri Lanka for the papal visit, and in the hotel room there's this green arrow on the ceiling, and I go, what is this green arrow? But you know, of course it's actually a majority Buddhist country with a lot of Muslims, and so Muslims there know what they can pray. I figured that out on the second day. Pray facing Jerusalem. The temple is the point of reference for all religion, so that the connection to God, the prayer relationship, always has to go through the temple, even if only through the direction one faces at prayer. Christians pray not in the direction of the temple, but toward the east. The rising sun, which triumphs over the night, symbolizes the risen Christ and is simultaneously understood to be a sign of his second coming. Through their position at prayer, Christians show that the direction toward the risen one, the rising sun, the risen one, is the true point of reference for their life with God. For this reason, eastward orientation has become the governing principle for Christian churches over the centuries. It is an expression of the omnipresence of the Lord, of the Lord's power to assemble, the Lord who reigns throughout the whole world like the rising sun. So here you have, in the shift, this is what Ratzinger is talking about. The shift took place and then fulfilled centuries later. And what Heschel is commenting on in Leviticus, you see its fulfillment, if you want to say, although Heschel probably wouldn't agree with that. The primacy of time over space. Now, we saw that in our own life of prayer in the translation, you know, when they redid the Missal. In the third Eucharistic prayer, they had that phrase, Uta solus ortu usque ad ocasum oblatum mundo offerato nomine tuo. From east to west, as it used to say, may a pure offering be offered to your name. And in the new version, it was corrected. So now it says from the rising of the sun to its setting. Now, that could just be it's a better translation of the Latin. It also echoes the psalm, which talks about the rising of the sun to its setting. But it's a dimension of, it's the primacy of time over space. East to west is space. The rising of the sun to its setting is actually time, and the time is what gives the space. Right? Why is something east? It's east because that's the rising sun, it's in that direction. It's the time that gives definition to the space. And in fact, it's not actually ever possible to be in the east. Wherever you are, there's a place further east or further west. It's a relative situation, right? But to be east is to be oriented towards the rising sun. So that's the, if you want to say, the theological depth of all of this, and why it is the case that how we live sacred time is a solid basis. I suppose you could say my argument to this in this section is basically that it's not just a sociological convenience. But there's a theological basis and a biblical basis for orienting ourselves in terms of time. Ratzinger again. It seems to me that the real, albeit misunderstood and for the most part unrecognized, driving force behind the restlessness of today's leisure time activities, behind the escape from everyday life and the pursuit of something completely different, is the yearning for that which the martyrs called Dominicus. Dominicus is not Dominica. It means, Ratzinger defines it in this elsewhere, I'm not going to quote it. It's not just the Lord's Day, but all those things that belong to the Lord. So the Lord's Day, the Lord's presence, to belong to Him. Somehow or the other to escape from the world that has us kind of trapped and to live in the freedom of the Lord. Dominicus is how he uses that term. So Ratzinger says, all this leisure activity that fills up our weekends is really a yearning for which the martyrs call Dominicus. That is, the longing for an encounter that makes life arise in us is the pursuit of what Christians received and are receiving on Sunday. Our question is, how can we show this to be the people to the people who seek it, and how can we find it again ourselves? Okay. So that brings us to the end of why Christian, why Catholic culture should be organized around the liturgical calendar. So now the rest of this is practical things. I have a handout here so you don't have to fear going home without a single word of mine being lost to memory. So these are practical suggestions. They have no more solid foundation than that they come from my own experience and ideas. I may, in modesty, say that's a good foundation. You may disagree, but that's all that they are. So these are not, this is not one of those talks where I have, where everything is collected from, you know, the 1973 subcommittee's directory on popular processions, those sort of things. I'm making fun of it, but those kinds of directories and compendia that put everything together are useful, but this is not that. This is just my thinking. Does everybody have one? There's extras for the archives, Roger. That's good to hear.
I will scan it and put it on the website, Ray, right up at the top.
So, the first thing, let's do the negatives, first of all. So, contemporary Catholic culture killers. What are things that kill Catholic culture? These are my views. Obviously, they're not the governing views of the Lord's Holy Church at the moment, but anyway, there they are. So, first thing, I think, is Saturday anticipated masses. One of my great pastoral achievements is I got rid of them at my parish. Now, I can do that. Why? You say, my goodness, the pastors are astonished and full of admiration, but my parish is on an island, so the people cannot flee to the next parish. So I can do that. I think one of the downs, I've been hearing at these at the meals last night and this morning, all the Boston priests talking about collaboratives and so forth. It's the latest hippest thing here in the Bay State. But one of the things I think there's actually an opportunity as we're trying to figure out what to do, we have fewer priests and fewer people and how to reorganize things, is to try and, you know, get rid of the Saturday Mass while in the midst of all this. And you have to do that, obviously, if you're not living on an island, you have to do it in geographical areas, otherwise people will just drive around and so forth. But they're a terrible idea, and because they are a definitive ascent by the church to a weekend culture instead of a Lord's Day culture, right? So you can't really say that the church in North America believes in the Sabbath or the Sunday, Lord's Day. We don't. We believe in the weekend. Because as we're discovering in relation to marriage, that is the hottest, hippest thing everybody's talking about in the world. It doesn't matter as much of what you teach as what you do. That's how people receive, right? So that's why there's all this big fight going on in Rome, or will be going on in the fall, is because they say if you change the pastoral practice, that's changing the teaching. Even if you say you're not changing the teaching, because that's how people live it. They don't live in people don't live in a document. They live in. So, if Catholic culture is reorganized around the liturgical year, and the heart of the liturgical year is Sunday, then if we don't believe in Sunday, we don't believe in the Lord's Day, which we don't, obviously, if we have masses every Saturday night, we believe in a weekend. And in Dies Domini, the Holy Father John Paul's letter on the Lord's Day, he talks about this weekend culture versus Sabbath culture, or the Lord's Day culture. And Benedict, in that part I quote about, also talks about weekend culture. Right? So we have a weekend culture. Right? Every pastor has those funny stories about the devout people who come to Mass Monday to Friday, come for the Saturday anticipated Mass, and don't come to Mass on Sunday. You know? There are people who've gone to Mass every weekend for their entire lives and rarely, if ever, been there on Sunday. So, one of the ways, aside from I can speak with great moral, was it righteous indignation, righteous, self-righteousness, whatever the thing we're not supposed to be is, I can speak with great self-righteousness because I got rid of mine, right? So I don't facilitate it like all of you do. But but one way that we can at least try to get away from this is by the words we use. And even the great Roger Landry last night talked about those who have lots of weekend masses. Did you not say that? Using the most profane adjectival weekend as opposed to the Lord's Day masses. I learned this not from me, from the Archbishop of Ottawa, Terry Prendergast. In all of his written things, in all of his, when he speaks, he'll say, I'm going to St. Martha's for the Lord's Day masses. He doesn't say, I'm going for the weekend. In everything that comes from the Chancery in Ottawa, it says, at the Lord's Day Masses, right? Now, in my diocese, Kingston, everything comes out, at your weekend Masses of such and such, please say this, or at these weekend Masses, you'll do that, right? He's the only one I know who makes, he probably's not the only one, but I know, because I know him, he's absolutely, he never says, I was at St. Martha's for Saturday evening Mass. He says, I was at St. Martha's for the Lord's Day Mass. On Saturday evening, we did this, right? So at least there's some sense. Most bulletins for most parishes, when I say most, I mean everyone that I've ever seen, or if you phone, they say, weekend, press 1 for the weekend Mass schedule, right? So solving the Saturday evening Mass problem, that's another great advantage of university chaplaincies. They're not looking for Saturday evening Masses. They don't want Saturday evening Masses. What they do come for is Sunday evening, which is fine. That's the Lord's Day. It's Emmaus. We're going to have that today. It's Emmaus. Isn't that the reading today? So, very biblical. We have to work on that. So that's one of the great killers of Catholic culture. If Catholic culture is going to be based on the Lord's Day, we have to at least get together on the Lord's Day. Another one is Friday abstinence, which, interestingly enough, in all those areas of the church where there's vitality, you see this as people are picking it up. My students are a big, they observe it. Not just because I encourage it, but I mean they have their own interior adherence to it. One of the most important things about Friday abstinence is that it allowed a way for non-practicing Catholics to be Catholic, to participate in the Catholic community, right? So the man who had left his wife and was living in a public state of sin, right back when those words were still used and so forth, could still abstain from meat on Fridays. A man who never set foot in a church, but was Catholic at a public function, could display, assert, identify with his Catholicism by having fish. When you remove things that people can do who are not at the heart of the faith, then you break down that culture. There have to be ways that people who are distant from the faith can practice the faith. This is one of the big problems, and why I presume that the Holy Father is so preoccupied with the question of how to get communion to people who are divorced and remarried. Because if that is the sign that you're part of the Catholic community, what does it say that if you're not, right? In fact, even Pope Francis has said, I think a little bit loosely, but anyway, he said it, that it's like you're excommunicated. Because the things, they can't do things that make you part of the Catholic faith. Well, if the only thing that you can do to be Catholic is to come to Mass, well, if you're not coming to Mass, then you're out somehow. You're distant. But the genius of Friday abstinence, aside from its penitential character, aside from calling to mind the Passion of the Lord, is that it was something that all Catholics could do, even if you weren't practicing. Even if you couldn't go to communion because you're in some irregular situation, you could still participate. You know, you could go to a restaurant and order the fish, right? It's one of the few things, by the way, that seems to have survived in the very secular culture, that there are certain restaurants that still have Friday's fish offerings on the menu.
Sure.
So that's another one. To bring that back, that was a great killer. I'm not sure what the American bishops have done on this. The Ontario bishops have never... They've always said that their preference is for Friday abstinence. I mean, it's just not very well observed, but they've always said it. And the British bishops, or England and Wales, have made some more formal step towards it. I'm not sure in the United States where it is. It might be done by region here, you know, Region 7, Region 2. If Friday falls on a Sunday, or Friday falls on a Monday after a Sunday, then maybe you don't observe it or whatever. All those peculiar bits of the American ecclesial landscape. That's it's like in the breviary, isn't it? After Christmas, if Friday falls on a Sunday, you know that the instructions there that are so confusing. Thanks be to God for our breviary now.
I think in Poland they still observe it.
Well, I don't know. Could be.
Sure, they do.
Okay. But it's a... I think that's a very... and I would mention, by the way, that we can start this one, we can start in our own Catholic institutions. I was at the Apostolic Nunciature in Ottawa on a Friday in ordinary time, and they served me reception. Now, that's just bad. That's just bad. Right? Okay, the third Catholic culture killer, ordinary time. It's lethal. It might be the most colossally bad phrasing in the history of religion. Ordinary time. How can you possibly be excited about ordinary time? You know? I don't understand. I don't know where it came from. I don't know why it's still here. In the Latin, it just says of the year, which is not, I wouldn't say it gets your blood pumping very fast. Oh, it's the 28th Sunday of the year. But I'm not sure where ordinary time came from. Richard Newhouse used to always try and salvage something out of this mess by saying the 23rd Sunday in well-ordered time. You try and make some order. But, you know, anyway, it's there, ordinary time. I don't know, somebody
ordinous.
Would... What's that?
From the Latin, ordinous.
But it doesn't say in the Missal, it doesn't say... Does it say that?
Peronum.
Yeah, it just says by the
right.
year.
But that's why I've heard that it comes from ordinance.
Okay. Could be. God bless you, Ray, for trying to salvage that. The Anglicans still keep the custom of saying so many Sundays after Epiphany and then after Pentecost, which at least ties you to some principal reality of the faith.
They say after Trinity.
After Trinity.
Yeah.
Thank you. But to tie it to something that's of importance makes sense. But we're stuck with that ordinary time. One of the ways that we can try and spice up ordinary time is the use of votive masses. You don't have to do it all the time, obviously, but if you have a week full of ferial days, you know, with the same, and if you choose to use the same prayers from Sunday onward, not that anybody remembers, I suppose, but you do at least, is to use votive masses. And there's that tradition of different days of the week being assigned to different devotions. I think Monday is the Holy Angels, isn't it? And, you know, Wednesday is St. Joseph, Saturday Our Lady, and I'm not sure what they all are, but that kind of idea to build up identity to Catholic culture. And of course, this would apply to your weekday mass crowd, but that crowd needs to live a Catholic culture if they're going to hand it on, especially to their young kids. And analogous to that is the dedication of various months, you know, different months of the year. January, the Holy Name. February.
Black History.
Right, Saint Martin de Porres, the super octave of Martin de Porres, Black History Month. But isn't that interesting? See, that's how you change culture. Everybody knows that February is Black History Month. They even make jokes about it, right? The blacks got the shortest month of the year, right? It's a very common joke. There's some black comedians that the white comedians don't really tell that joke, but the black comedians do. But if people know that, it's, you know, Black History Month. Well, February, March, St. Joseph, and so on. August, Immaculate Heart. May, October, also Marian months. So the whole point of these things is, how do you use them? Is that you talk about them, you can even decorate, you know, if your parish office, we have a calendar every month on the inside of the chaplaincy, which has all the days of all the saints' days for that whole year. Is made up by some homeschooling family, and we got a copy of it. And on the month, it says January, February, tells you what month it is. All these things help to build up that Catholic culture that I'm living in this world, but the rhythms of my life are not determined by it. Okay. Sunday in the liturgical year, that actually is, it should be, it's a foot, there's meant to be a footnote there. Does your copy have a footnote on it?
No.
It's from Dies Domini 76. So that was meant to be a quotation just for your edification. So, John Paul says there, human psychology in fact desires the celebration of anniversaries, associating the return of dates and seasons with remembrance of past events, which you can see if you know what the liturgy is, which all of you fathers do, it's a making present, it's a remembrance, and we do that with birthdays, anniversaries, all those sort of things, and so that's the psychological basis for that. So that actually is to be footnoted. My mistake. That's Dies Domini, which was published in 1998 on Pentecost. Interesting, and it's number 76, I believe. I think when I put this in, this got printed in WordPad or something, and I think the footnotes may have disappeared anyway. Pentecost. I think I've become convinced this is important. That is also, the bullet points are mine. The actual paragraph is John Paul and Dies Domini, 77. Sorry about that. They didn't have Word on this thing, so I printed WordPad and I lost some of the, well, obviously lost the footnotes, so I'm sorry about that. So that's that. This is John Paul II. After Easter and Pentecost, the most solemn celebrations and the Nativity of the Lord, etc. What struck me there is that he says after Easter and Pentecost, undoubtedly the next most solemn celebration is the Nativity. I think if you were to ask, well, I don't know if you asked me, but probably most of you, what are the great Christian feasts? You'd say, well, Christmas and Easter, right? He puts Christmas, at least it appears implicitly here, but Easter, Pentecost, Christmas. Now, even if you just say it's all on the same level, the point is we don't observe Pentecost that way. I think this is we did in my parish one year a vigil of Pentecost.
On Saturday afternoon, Raymond?
Well, exactly.
Saturday afternoon.
It was Saturday night, because that's when the vigils are.
See? Just ask it.
Could you imagine the absurdity of these poor fathers with parishes, which you used to have, I know, Roger, who have their big high Pentecost Mass at 4:30, and then they have the vigil of Pentecost at 7 o'clock. Yeah, that shows the absurdity of it all. It'd be like having an Easter vigil. Imagine if you had your Easter Saturday evening, 5 p.m. Mass, and you had the vigil later on that night. But the vigil of Pentecost, it's there. The new missal makes it actually much more abundantly clear than the old missal used to have. The old translation kind of left it out. I think we should have the Pentecost vigil. Now, and the beauty of that vigil is that it's going to only attract the most devout. It's not for the broader culture. And that's what makes it good. Because, not that the broader culture isn't what we're interested in, but if you're trying to create a Catholic subculture, you have to do things which distinctively, or which actively distinguish yourself from the majority, which Christmas no longer does. Easter does to a lesser degree. But if you want people to be proud of being Catholic, who say, I'm Catholic, this is how I organize my life, they have to be at things where only those who are proud of being Catholic are there. Not that we drive people out, but you have to have things that reinforce that. And the vigil of Pentecost is one of those. Right? No one is going to say, oh my goodness, it seems like Pentecost has rolled around. We better all figure out where the church is and, you know, get over there as they do for Christmas or Easter. It's actually quite a beautiful liturgy as well. And from the point of view of the pre-celebrant, far less complicated than the Easter Vigil. So it's not, you don't get the distraction, all the choreography. So, recovery of the Pentecost Vigil. Now, this is not something I've done with the students, because in Canada, our school year ends at the end of April. So they're not around. We're not around for Pentecost. So I've not tried it with the students. But I did it once with the parish, and it, I think, I'd say, modest success. For other reasons, if you built it up year by year, I think that could be something that would be important. Even if your confirmation is at another time, that would be an excellent moment to introduce the confirmed or newly confirmed or something distinctively Catholic that's not their confirmation. itself. And then some priests I know have used it, not the Pentecost Vigil, which I would advise, but Pentecost for the commissioning of those things in the parish that are more missionary oriented. So if you have teams that are specifically evangelistic, or at least implicitly evangelistic, they can be commissioned. Right? One of the things I've learned with young people, we're called Catholic Christian Outreach Missionaries, you call them FOCUS here in the United States. They're commissioned every year. There's an act of commissioning. You're the bishop, sometimes I do it myself. That could be done in a parish around Pentecost. Okay, this is your mission. And the advantage, it's a purely religious feast with no secular counterpart. Major feasts in ordinary time. Now, I'm not sure if you fathers are aware of this. If you are, then you're an exceptionally well-informed group, because most priests don't actually know it. But in the norms of the liturgical calendar, so the constitution that governs the liturgical calendar, if you go all the way down, the last number, number 58, it's my favorite one because it's part of the liberation. It's your day of emancipation clause from ordinary time. It says, for the pastoral advantage of the people, it is permissible to observe on the Sundays of ordinary time those celebrations that fall during the week and have special appeal to the devotion of the faithful. Or if you're the pastor, you can interpret the devotion of the faithful. Provided the celebrations take precedence over these Sundays and the table of different liturgical days. Masses for such celebrations may be used at all masses at which your congregation is present. So, that means in ordinary time, if there is a feast of the Lord, or a solemnity, which could either be a solemnity of a saint or a proper solemnity, like your patronal day, they can be transferred to Sunday. Right? So, practically speaking, it means Presentation of the Lord, Sacred Heart of Jesus, St. John the Baptist, St. Peter and Paul, Transfiguration, Assumption, Triumph of the Cross, All Saints, and Dedication of the Lateran. All those feasts can be transferred to Sunday and observed on Sunday in their proper festivity. In addition to those, all of your proper solemnities, not feasts, depends if it's a feast of the Lord or of a saint, but your proper solemnities, which would be the patronal day of your parish, dedication day of your parish, and because the dedication of a church is a feast of the Lord, and in a diocese the dedication of the cathedral is a feast of the Lord for the parishes, a solemnity in the cathedral, also the dedication day of your cathedral. So these can all be. Now, in my own practice, I don't shift them all, because I think if you do them all, it just becomes too much. But you can knock out half of ordinary time with this, if you want. And the people respond. You can get excited about, oh, what's going on today? It's the presentation of the Lord. Or what's going on today? It's the Immaculate Heart of Mary. That's my parish patronal day. No one gets excited about the 17th Sunday. It's impossible to be excited about it.
Speak for yourself.
I'm speaking, as I said earlier, Roger, pay attention, I said, this is only myself, no other basis here. So, choose a few, you can alternate them in different years to elevate different, to highlight different things, or if there are some that are of important locale. For example, there are a lot of parishes that will have, according to the temporal calendar, not the sacred calendar, some festival. So they have the parish picnic in the last week of June. And it's a big deal, everybody comes out for it, it's a huge event. Why not celebrate Peter and Paul or John the Baptist on that day? Right? Or Sacred Heart, depending on how it falls. So that's permissible. It's done. The only time I remember it being done in Rome was at the Consistory for Cardinals in 2012. They were made cardinals on the Saturday, and that Sunday was the Sunday before Ash Wednesday. Ash Wednesday that year was the 22nd of February, which is a solemnity in the Vatican, chair of St. Well, it's a solemnity at the altar of the chair, anyway. And so they moved it to Sunday, so they could celebrate. They didn't celebrate whatever the sixth Sunday at ordinary time was. But this can really be a way to bring a feast, highlight, and explain to the people, especially in my parish, it's great because they have these annual missals, the St. Joseph's. I don't think we have them in the United States, but we have them in Canada. St. Joseph's missals. So that's all the readings for the whole year. They're in the pews, everything for the year. So at the beginning of the Mass, I can say, well, today we're observing the feast of St. John the Baptist, great feast in Quebec. And so the readings and the prayers will not be as in your missals. Immediately they say, okay, there's something different, right? And then you can build around it. And of course, your preaching would reflect it. Okay, the Feast of the Saints. One of the things that surprised me pleasantly about going to work on campus was how interested young people are who are new to practicing the faith in the lives of the saints. They just can't get enough of it. They just love the lives of the saints. So I use all the optional memorials that are there. I preach frequently in the lives of the saints. I say indulge in the adventure of liturgical abuse. That's why this is not a doctrinal or magisterial document. And celebrate recent beati whose universal cult has not been approved. Although it is true in the current pontificate, you're never quite sure when a when a beatus might get the upgrade, just like that. So, but I do that. I know you're not allowed to do it. I'll answer before the throne of judgment on that, without great worry. One day, I think. But there's a lot of beati who are closer to us in time, and people to learn about them. I've listed some here. That there's this new one from South Africa. It's an amazing case. Died in 1990 in the Feast of the Presentation, who was martyred, stoned to death because he opposed witchcraft in South Africa. It's 1990. Right? You know, he refused to participate in witchcraft. The town, there was a storm. They wanted to find out who was the witch who brought the storm. So they're going to hire a witch doctor to find them out. Everyone's going to give a collection to pay the witch doctor. And this fellow said, I'm Catholic. I'm not going to contribute to hiring a witch doctor. And they martyred him. 1990, less than 25 years ago. These stories are, and then you can try and build something around the actual observance. Oscar Romero of El Salvador will be beatified next month. Pier Giorgio of Turin, obviously very, very popular on campus. Mother Teresa, very well known. Cardinal Newman. These are all blesseds who the people have great followings for. And if you take a more observant approach, and you don't want to participate and you don't want to celebrate those masses, then don't. But you can still mention it in the preaching, right? You can use the prayers, but you can mention the preaching. If you don't use the prayers, that's obviously, I'm not going to quibble with that. One thing that I've discovered is useful is to set aside special periods in the liturgical year. As people like festivals and so forth. I learned this because, you know, on campus there's all kinds of things. Like there's Frosh Week, obviously the most, come back, Frosh Week. There's Homecoming. Those are the two big things every campus has. But then there's all sorts of things. There's a special week for this, a special week for that.
Or there's a special fortnight in the United States. Yes. Because somebody with this principle was
yes.
involved in that.
And so here is a list of things here that use the liturgical year as suggestions to galvanize, to say, okay, in this parish, in this community, we're going to observe these dates in a certain way. Okay? So, for example, last year I talked about these two martyrs of John Paul, Father Yershi and Father Pino. Their feast days all fall, one's the 19th, one's the 21st, John Paul's on the 22nd. You could do a nice little triduum of, you know, evening holy hours or something. There are two Marian weeks that come in the year. One is in December, in Advent, from the Immaculata, the 8th of December to the 12th, Guadalupe. Juan Diego comes on the 9th. You could have a Marian week in your parish. You can also do it in September, which is, especially at the beginning of the school year, might be a great way to introduce these children to some Marian culture, because you have three Marian feasts right after, one after the Holy Name, Nativity on the 8th, Holy Name on the 12th, and Our Lady of Sorrows on the 15th, right? So you've got, in a week, three Marian feasts. You could see a lot of easy things you could do, especially in a school, to introduce children to Marian culture. If you want to do something on the apostles, you know, start it in Feast of Conversion of Paul and go to the Chair of St. Peter. Now, often Lent starts in there, so sometimes that can get complicated. But if you want to do something about the apostles, you know, that one year you could do that. The Holocaust martyrs, Edith Stein and Maximilian Kolbe, are both in August, August 9th and August 14th, you know, 5 days apart. If you want to do Canadians, I don't know if that would appeal to anybody outside of Canada, but we got the double upgrade last year. Vatican announced we got two new saints, just like that. Maria of the Incarnation and Francois de Laval, their feast days are 7 days apart. You want to talk about the cross. If you got Italians who love Padre Pio, or just people love Padre Pio, you know, and you want to sort of give a little bit of a deeper understanding that he's not just a wonder worker, with the conformity of the cross, we'll start something on the Triumph of the Cross on the 14th and go to the 23rd. And then the Fortnight for Freedom, which is the American Bishops' Religious Liberty Committee, a suggestion from the Vigil of Thomas More, and you've got all the martyrs there, John the Baptist, Peter and Paul, all the way through Independence Day. So I think these things are very, because they're focused. You're not doing a 13-week seminar. These five, what are we going to do in these 5 days for Mary? What are we going to do in this month to talk about the apostles? Right? And what it does is, it if you do enough of these things and you have that pattern, it helps people to think in terms of the year as a liturgical reality. In terms of preaching the feast day, in the Directory of Homiletics, one thing that struck me was that in the advice given to homilists in the Directory, especially in the section on Lent, they often suggest taking your lead from the preface or the collect. Which I must say, on occasion, rarely have I done it, but I always thought it was kind of a little bit dodgy because you're supposed to be talking about the scriptures, and it says, well. So, if you're preaching on a saint's day, and the saint has a proper antiphon, as they often do, some taken from their writings or something, then by all means, playing fast and loose if you preach on the collect or on the preface. And of course, the collect sometimes very specifically, like think of the collect for John Henry Newman or the collect for John Paul, right? John Paul, and the collect for John Paul is Dives in Misericordia and Redemptor Hominis. So there you go, you've got a homily based on the collect. So that's just to note that. Then there are other things in the liturgical year which can be fun. One is that there are these 40-day periods in the year. You can choose that there are four of them. There's the Christmas to the Presentation, which I talked about in relation to Queen Elizabeth. To give that sense of Christmas being not just something that finishes on December the 26th. Lent is, of course, you don't have to do much for that. Lent is probably the best observed liturgical period of all. There's the next 40, which is Easter to the Ascension, depending on where you live, obviously. And then the fourth 40, which is quite interesting, the Transfiguration to the Holy Cross, right? Which in a certain sense takes out of the drama of Holy Week, where you're talking about the triumph of the cross on Friday, and then 24 hours later you're back in the church for the Easter Vigil. Well, the idea of the cross as the glorification or the manifestation of the Lord's glory is held up by these this 40-day period from the Transfiguration to the triumph of the cross. I'm not sure why they're 40. I'm not sure why the history of it is, but it's not accidental, right? That the Transfiguration and the triumph of the cross go together 40 days apart. I don't think you'd have a 40-day devotion, but you might have something to bring that to people's attention. Octaves, I think, are very good, right? We have two, Christmas and Easter. They're not very well observed, partly because most parish priests and most parishes are a little bit worn out. So we're all here in Easter octave. Right? Christmas octave, Easter octave are not well observed, and it's not a criticism. I mean, who really on Easter Monday or Easter Tuesday wants to have a big parish do? It's just not feasible. So liturgically important, but we can't actually live them. Pentecost used to have its octave. It was suppressed. But doesn't mean, I've done this several years, it depends on where it falls, but if you have a week of ferial masses after Pentecost, you can have a week of votive masses of the Holy Spirit, and you have an octave of Pentecost, right? There used to be an octave of Peter and Paul, which I discovered when I saw a letter from Thomas More, who's martyred on July the 6th, and he was writing to someone, and he said, when he knew his execution date, and he said, what a blessing to be martyred on the Vigil of Peter and Paul. I thought, well, was the Feast of Peter and Paul later back then? No, but it had an octave. So it was the end of the octave, was the 7th, and the octave day was celebrated as kind of like the feast day, so I didn't know that. I'm not saying, but you could do those things with ferial masses. And then, of course, another Marian week or Marian octave, which does actually exist, is the Assumption to the Queenship, right, in August. So those things can all be there. So finally, just some things from campus, things that we've done. So this is our liturgical rhythm on campus. Of course, we have our Sunday Mass, which is an evening Mass. Then we have a Thursday Mass and dinner, which is our, obviously, the Holy Mass, and then a social time. So those are our weekly appointments we have every single week. And then we have these periodic things that give the students something to organize towards that consecrates the liturgical year. So the first one, we don't have anything in September, so I've got to think, should we have Marian Week, should we have Triumph of the Cross or whatever? But the first one is October 31st, the All Saints Vigil. So that's beautiful, because there's all this nonsense on campus going on Halloween, and the Christian kids, Catholic kids can come, and it's basically an extended Vespers, rather extended Holy Hour with readings from the Lives of the Saints, and then you can assign the readings and they do it. But there's a beautiful time, okay, either you're with the world or you're Catholic, and they love that because they want to be Catholic, right? The second one we do is Advent Lessons and Carols. Most of you are familiar with various versions of it. And we do it for Advent. No, Chris, we don't sing, you know, Little Town of Bethlehem. We don't sing, you know, Away in a Manger. All Advent hymns, Advent readings. We do that, which comes towards the end of the first semester. Our students are away for Christmas, so we don't do any Christmas Epiphany things. So we started this year, actually, presentation, something to end the Christmas season. And it was their idea. They wanted a procession. I told them the kinds of things they could do. They wanted the Marian procession through their campus. Their idea, not mine. And then we had Mass by candlelight, which is beautiful. So no artificial lights in the chapel, just candles. And, of course, emphasize, you know, Christ's light of the world. We have a custom on this. So that's, then we have Lent. On the Feast of St. Joseph, we have our Mass. And then after the Mass, the women in the community prepare a meal and serve the men. So the men just sit down and they're served. The women come up, they serve, and you know it's not very complicated, a complex meal. And this year they made crowns for them. So they had me present to them with little virtues on it, and it's very sweet. And then the following week on the Annunciation, we reverse it.
Less
complicated. And the men do. Well, the men do. It was actually very funny because the men do. They usually do a wine and cheese because. You know, but they dress up for it. It's very elegant. It's really well done, and they honor the. They call it the honoring, the women's honoring, the men's honoring. I used to buy carnations for them to give to the girls every year, which they did. And this year I was very busy, so I left it up to them. And I came to the function after the Mass, came downstairs, and they all get roses. So I'll get the bill. Don't worry about it, though. But they went and bought themselves. So, but it's a very beautiful. It's a really beautiful, and we've done it about 4 or 5 years now. And this year, I was really struck. I didn't even say, you know, back in January, are we planning for this? They knew, and they look for it. They love it, and they love to invite their friends. The girls love it because they invite their friends, and these girls who maybe are new to Newman House say they think men existed like this. So that's what we do. Then we have we do the seven last words on Good Friday. This. Readings, preaching, I do the preaching and then music, the student choir. And now, Good Friday in the United States is a lot different because it's a working day, so you don't have as much flexibility. Anyway, those are just things that we've done that create a common culture. I would just say one last thing. One of the things I learned that you, Roger, mentioned last night, Cardinal Dolan, one of the things that he was very good about is that in his ordinary speech, he would often speak about feast days. And even now, I'm still in touch with him, and he'll say things to me, like he'll say, Ray, we should do that before the Little Flower. Or we'll do that on the Exaltation of the Cross. Or let's do that for Corpus Christi. And so you have to, first of all, know your calendar. Now, it's not a way to show people how pious we are, but you know, to use that, that way, there used to be the custom of dating letters. You put the date, you know, 1st of October, put a little flower underneath. These kinds of ways help build up, Catholic culture in our conversation. And in the chaplaincy, whenever we do anything that's anything out of the ordinary, we try and find a feast day, you know, if we're going to honor somebody or, you know. And interestingly enough, now the engagements that come through the chaplaincy, we had one on the Feast of the Holy Rosary this year in the chapel. We had another one on the Feast of St. Joseph. So you should, obviously I'm not directing them how they organize their proposals, but they begin to live liturgically. Okay, I should finish there. I'll leave this on the table. This is the magazine that I edit. It's been a couple years now. This is the latest issue, February, March. 2015, Convivium, Faith in Our Common Life. It's kind of, it's like the first things, but not as scholarly. Anyway, but that was kind of fun, I think. So,
a few minutes.
Yeah, Tom?
If I can offer just a bit of practical
sure.
advice or suggestion.